Okay, I'm back. What is that? Whole video channel soon. We will be phasing out support for your browser soon. Huh, that's strange. Okay, good evening, one and all. I need to update. I don't know. Okay, No, as long as you're in charge, I don't worry about anything. And Oki and Larry, I need to get some idea of plans from you because tickets are available as of today. You sent one? When? Isn't it a great conversation? I'm talking, she's typing. It's kind of weird and creepy. You sent me an email on August 3rd? Wow, man, you guys are a different time zone and different day zone, too. How cool is that? Oh. Thought maybe you're on a different planet or something. What's this, like August 3rd on Mars or something? Okay. All right. For those of you in here that are new, and I'm not sure which one of you are new, but for those of you that are new, if you don't have fun in this class, it's not my fault, because I have a lot of fun. I always start off with any questions. Oh, yeah, Oki and Larry coming out to see us. That ought to be crazy. Yeah. Omar, go ahead and type it up. Wireless mouse signal quality is low. That's weird. What is that? Yes, dear. Rabbi, when we do something wrong and Hashem deals with us, is it right to say he's punishing us or rectifying us, even though it might seem like punishment? That's a very broad question. Blee Nader. Ah, yeah, good stuff. Okay, Rabbi, when we do something wrong. Now, Omar, let's dissect this a little bit. When we do something wrong, when you do something wrong, it's much different in Jewish thought than it is in, say, Christian thought. In Jewish thought, we call it missing the mark. It's a chait. It's like, if you ever played darts, the easiest analogy is, if you've ever played darts, and you throw your darts, you're always trying to hit the red or the green in the center, right? But you don't always hit it. So what do? Quit the game just because you can't hit it? No. You pick up your darts, you go back, and you try again. So when you do something wrong, as in make a mistake, you ask for forgiveness. We call it teshuva. And you try it again. We do something wrong, and God deals with us. The interesting thing about God is God wants us to say we are sorry. He wants to give us every opportunity to make amends for what we've done wrong. And he may send out a gezerah, he may send out punishment to be meted out, but as you realize what you have done and you apologize for what you've done, that little piece of paper, that whatever that is going to punish you, is held off, as long as you don't do the same thing again. Is it right to say he's punishing us or rectifying us through, though it might seem like punishment? Here's an interesting thought, Omar. Everything God does is for good. How's that for an interesting answer? Is he punishing us? As a parent who does not want their child to run out into the street, gives them a little potch and corrects them, that's kind of what we believe God does for us and to us. If all of a sudden, as an example, something started going downhill in our life, a relationship, a job got difficult, someone got sick, most what Jews will do at that point is take a look, maybe check our mezuzahs, check our tefillin, tighten up our prayer, pray for these people, and take a look at what we've done, and maybe we have done something wrong and don't even know it. And so the beauty of that is we have an opportunity to make it right. Another very interesting thing, Omar, I would say figure out how the mistake relates to punishment. That's very difficult because we don't understand God's punishment. If I jaywalk, it's not necessarily a death penalty, and I'm not even sure. So as far as God never gives us more than we can handle. Translate that into what Noahides need to check, please. I have no idea what that means. I'm sorry. I do apologize. So what I'm doing is giving you an example of what we do. We take a look at what we do, how we interact with people. Perhaps you had said something in passing that was either taken wrong, or you said something in anger, or a gesture, or something done, or not returning an object, or someone coming by to borrowing something, and you told them to buzz off. Those are the things that can, in some way or another, get you in trouble, or maybe you're just malicious towards somebody. And if we're all made in God's image, like it says in Bereshis, which we are, when you're talking to a person, you're talking to an image of God. So when we do something wrong in some faiths, once you do something wrong, you're done, you're toast, you're going to hell, you're done, you're going to burn. There's no way back. What do they say in their Bible? Our deeds are like dirty rags or something like that. I think I've heard that quote somewhere. We have a Torah and a set of laws that we need to follow. You have seven. And we've discussed this in class before, and this is what is so remarkable. I think this is part of my draw to this class. Part of my draw. Number one, I think righteous Gentiles are some of the coolest people I ever met. You guys are just the coolest people I ever met. Most of you, if not all of you, have taken a tremendous leap into a huge unknown. Rabbi, since I decided to seek the right pathway by following the Noahide, I experienced some difficulty. Now I'm afraid to tell my friends that I'm now a member of Noahide because they think I'm being punished by my previous God. Can you give me some advice? My hope and my wish and my prayer with your financial difficulties is, I don't know more of the details. If you would like, you're more than welcome to email me, and I can give you give me a little few more details, and I can give you a few more details. But things happen to us like that little pot, like a parent's going to do, to take a look at who we are and what we've done. Luisito, I would strongly consider, and I would strongly take a look at your interactions towards other people. And take your interactions towards your family and yourself. Is there something that's lying around your house that maybe shouldn't be there? Maybe it's some sort of statue that you have to nullify. We've talked about that in the book. Maybe it's an interaction with somebody. There you go. Larry just says maybe it's a test. And trust me, the more you know, and the more sincere you are, Luisito, the more the other side wants to drag you back. Now, if you take a look at this, think about this, Luisito. You left idolatry. You embraced the seven laws. The other side doesn't want you to become a righteous Gentile. The other side, as in the adversary, a.k.a. the bad guy, Satan, if you will, the adversary. And what you're doing is you're making the adversary's life very difficult by doing the right thing and leaving idolatry. So what does he do? He tosses something. It's either going to be relationship, it's going to be financial, or it's going to be personal, or it's going to be health. One of those four things get tossed in your direction to find out what you're going to do. And I think what would be interesting, Lucito, is to write down in the calendar specifically, or write down in the journal specifically what's going on, deal with it, pray, have friends pray, etc., which is wonderful. God loves to hear from you. And just watch on your calendar. What happens if something physically goes? Let's suppose something physically. You come down with a flu or something like that. Okay? Some sort of sickness. And it's another test. What about a relationship? Maybe people do find out that you're now a Ben Noach. And there may be some personal issues there. But these are all tests to find out how much you're willing to do and how far you're willing to go. My wife and I get tested all the time. I mean, we're in a community that hopefully we'll be out of soon. That is a religious wasteland. I mean, some of the things that go on in this town is toxic. It really is. It's toxic. We were invited to a memorial service for a friend, a very nice lady. Very nice lady who recently passed away. For obvious reasons, we couldn't go, and the obvious reasons was this lady was a Reformed Jew, and as an Orthodox Jew, I'm not allowed to go into the sanctuary of a Reformed synagogue. Can't even walk in the door. It is forbidden. And there's a whole bunch written about that. And so my wife and I had a couple of choices. We could go there and kind of hang around outside and give our condolences, and people would ask us to come in, and we can kind of say no, and that would have been a little battle there, which I didn't really want to go into. Or we could send somebody with our condolences. Somebody went with our condolences. Sorry, couldn't be there, you know, whatever we did. And that seemed to be enough, and that's good. But we get these things tossed in front of us, tossed at our feet. We get these interactions with people, places, and things. And it's all a test. How strong are you in what you believe? How strong are you in these laws? I mean, is this going to be it? Or are you going to be able to be easily enticed back? It's a test. Simple. It's a test. Okay? And don't forget, Luisito, God never gives us more than we can handle. Sometimes we get up to about here with it, but he never gives us more than we can handle. Okay, anybody else got a question? Hopefully that answered it. That was a little dissertation, wasn't it? Mini dissertation. I'd get a yarmulke with a propeller on it. How cool would that be? Okay, any other questions? What was great? My yarmulke with a propeller on it? How cool would that be? People would have a fit about that one. And they had a store here who sold baseball caps with propellers. I was just going to cut the brim off it and wear it. That would kind of make some people insane. Oh, thank you. So hopefully that clear things up for you, Luisito. Am I pronouncing your name right? Luisito. That's a little Luis. Oh, thank you, Steve. I'll pass it on to my lovely wife, which I think is still in here, and she'll be very happy for that. Other zero added to my paycheck. Wow, thanks. Means a lot to us. Or two. Wow. I love getting raises. I think what also makes people mad is my wife and I do this because we like you guys, not because of any financial remuneration. Yeah, we do have a lot of zeros. We hear three. So I hope everybody understands that. We're not doing this because somebody is sending us a paycheck. We're doing this because we really believe in the steps you've taken to leave what you're in and become a righteous Gentile. Luisito, our pleasure. Our pleasure. But I really want you folks in here to know that I'm very impressed. I like the emails that I've recently received. I like a lot of the comments. Oh, cool. Well, it means little Luis, right? Luisito. I know a little bit of Spanish, enough to get my face slapped, probably. Okay, no other questions? I'm going to move on. Does everybody have this book yet, The Divine Code? Really? Everybody have it? Is Volume 2 out yet, Oki? No? So what's the story with Volume 2? It's supposed to be out... Okay. You just got your Chumash MJS? Very wonderful. MJS, do you know how to use it? Does everybody out there have a Stone Edition Chumash? Is it the Stone Edition MJS? Is that what it is? Do you know how to use it? That a yes or a no? Do you know how to use it? MJS, do you have your Chumash with you? Okay. Open it up to Genesis 1:1. This is great. I'll tell you guys how to read this thing and how to make your week very interesting. Yeah. Okay. Now look on the right hand side where all the Hebrew is. You see that? Look in the margin. Go down the margin and you'll see a word. The second one down, you'll probably see either on the first page or the second page, is in Hebrew a three-letter word. Then after that, it's a four-letter word in the margin, okay, in bold. You see those? Okay. If you count those, if you count each one of those, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, you count those, and that's your reading for Sunday, is the first section, from the beginning of Genesis 1:1 all the way down to that three-letter word. Read that repeatedly, take a look at why things are the way they are, and look at the commentaries. That's one day, that's Sunday. Monday, do from that three-letter word to the four-letter word. That's the second aliyah to the third. And then after that, you do the fourth, then the fifth. And that's how you read it. That's how you split up a Torah portion. And what you're doing is you're reading a Torah portion in a week. Instead of sitting down and reading it all at once because it's just too much information. Okay? Who put that up? Okay, this is Oki put this up. Take a look at this. Numbers from the browser, cool. Numbers 30 to 31 is the first. 13 to 31, 54 is second. And what it does is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, that takes a week. Okay, Francis, are you in Genesis 1:1? Okay, Genesis 1:1 on the right-hand side. Go down in the margin on the side, and maybe on the next page, and you'll see a three-letter word in Hebrew. And if you know Hebrew, shin nun yud, which is sheni, which is the second aliyah. You see that? Really? Okay. Let me get my wifey.
Hey, wifey, would you bring me a chumash, please?
With a JPS? You can't do it with a JPS. I don't think JPS has that worked out that way. Francis, is yours a JPS? If it is, this won't work. In the column. Oh, you have a Stone Edition? Okay, I'll give you page numbers. Thank you, wifey. Okay, Francis, and anybody else out there who wants to learn how to read this thing? Because it can be quite voluminous. Okay, Francis. Page 2. Okay? page 2, you see in the margin a very dark letter, which is an aleph, which is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Kind of looks like an X. You see that? You got that? Okay. From that, in the English, would be the left-hand side, all the way through... Whoa, where's Shani? Wow. There it is. All the way through page 10, right below the bet. Okay? Go to page 10, go down the column, and right there, right at the new paragraph, there is a three-letter word in Hebrew. Okay? So Monday, you'll go from the beginning all the way to that, and you read the commentaries. Okay? Then on Tuesday, you go from that on page 10 to the bottom of page 12. You see that one? That is a five-letter word. Okay? That's Shlishi. That's the third Aliyah. Then from page 12 all the way through, the middle of 18, middle of page 18. That's on day 4, which would be Wednesday. Then from there, to go to Chamishi, which is on page 22, and they got a short one, 22, and right below that is a three-letter word. On 22, that's it for that Torah reading, from Chamishi to Shishi, then from Shishi to the end. See? Got that? So what that does is there are 7 aliyahs, 7th, and then you have Maftir, and as long as you follow those on each day, you get through the Torah portion in a week. Sometimes it's a long reading, sometimes it's a short reading. But if you read that section, Francis, on any Torah portion, if you read it from the beginning of the Torah portion to that three-letter word in Hebrew, which is means sheni, means second, and you read all the commentaries associated with that and go over it a couple of times, because usually there is a lot of action-packed stuff in a Torah portion, and especially this week. This week it deals with vows and such. There is a ton of information. And the commentaries will even set you into some other areas. I don't know which books you have in the house, but it'll set you off into some other books, and you can search the web, and there's plenty of websites where you can take a look and get a lot of great information. Okay? Any other questions? Hopefully that was helpful. Yay! That was piece of cake. I'm going for another raise. Soon we'll be paying off the national debt in zeros. All right. 2 more zeros. Cool beans. All right, anybody in here for the first time? Woo-hoo, 4-star. Anybody in here for the first time so I can say hello to you? Yes, no, maybe? Anybody? No newbies, or are you guys all shy? We won't have Chesed in here this week. He's on vacation. He's somewhere resting and recuperating and inhaling mountain air somewhere. Okay, we're on page... This is amazing. We're on page 276, chapter 3, the prohibition of blasphemy. Now, what's fascinating about this, and this is what will happen, and you can ask my wifey about this. This is kind of cool. What happens is you will start your studies on a particular subject matter, all right? And as you're studying, you're going to go into some other books and look at some other things. And what you're going to discover is there's going to be a common thread through everything that you study. And if that comes up, don't let that surprise you, because that seems to be how it works. My wife and I have this tendency that when we're studying something, no matter which book we go to pick up, to take out, to look at something, there's always a common thread all the way through everything we do in a particular study session that we have. And I always found that just amazing. Now, this week in Torah, there's a double Torah portion. It brings us to the end of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. Matos Messiah, the Messiah Matos is the Torah portions, plural. And the first Torah portion covers vows. Yeah, you'll see that a lot, Francis, the more you study. So what it's going to discuss in the Torah portion this week are oaths and vows, which is going to be an interesting discussion because we're going to get to the part where, in Jewish thought, a father can annul the vows of his wife or daughters. Or not. This week in chapter 3, it starts off with laws of vows and promises. See what I mean? So what happens is we're starting in and we're doing some studying and we're doing the divine code and we are in line with the Torah portion. If you take a look at this week's Torah portion in your Stone Edition, you're going to find someone vows a vow or makes an oath and how to nullify it. It's very interesting. And how that happens, mine's greater than I. Okay, if no other questions, I'm going to go on because I'd like to get through some of this stuff. Yes, no, maybe. Okay. Oh, look, MJS is on a timeout. Sorry, that's my school teaching days. All right. Number one on page 276. Now, some people have said, oh, you're just reading out of the book. Yes, I do read a section out of the book, but I do explain it because, like anything, the written word and the spoken word, the written word is wonderful. The way this book is put together is very, very easily digestible. Anybody who's read this book or taken a study, there is a lot of information in here, and this Kitzer, Shulchan Aruch for the Sheva Mitzvahs, is a very, very, very concise, and it's a very well-written book, in my opinion. I like it a lot. But what you're going to do is you're going to take the written word and you've got to supplement it. You have to supplement what's in here with examples. Because if somebody, if you just hear it and just listen to me read it, first of all, you go to sleep and you start taking zeros away from my paycheck. Secondly, you fall asleep. And third, you just go, I don't want to be in that class anymore. But if you take what's written in here and you tie it in with appropriate examples, and you tie it in with maybe personal things that I have run into, it makes the book come alive and it makes the book practical. And that's what it is. This is a very practical book. God willing, we'll have volume 2 out real soon. Okay. A Gentile does not have a specific commandment to fulfill any promises or vows he makes. Gentiles have not been warned against transgressing their words. In any case, now here's where it gets good. In any case, even though they are not commanded regarding this as a thing which is obligatory according to human intelligence, every person is obliged to keep his word. And how much more so not to lie about the past. So there is no obligation for a righteous Gentile to abide by any oath or vow they make. You can say, sure, dude, I'll be at your house tomorrow morning and we'll have steak and eggs. It's on me. You don't ever have to show up. However, being righteous Gentiles, underlying the word righteous, we don't do things like that. We just don't do things like that. If you're going to tell somebody you're going to do something or be someplace at a certain time, do it. Just do it. If you're not sure, let's suppose I'm going to say, as an example, I've been riding my bike a lot lately. It's been kind of fun. I'm trying to get it over 100 miles a week. So, yeah, it does, Okie. So I've been on my bike, and my brother and I meet somewhere on the path, or he comes here, and we ride from here, and I'll tell him, I'll meet you at my house at 5:30 in the morning for a bike ride. He says, okay, I will be there. So what I've said, I will do something. He says he will do something. So in essence, once we've said we're going to do something, we're obligated or else. But if I say to him, go ahead and get on the bike path, I, without a vow, will meet you over at the college and we'll go ride 50 miles. I haven't vowed a vow. Okay? Has everybody heard this song? I'm sure somewhere, sometime. A nader, yeah, exactly. It's very difficult to translate. Have you heard of this word? Sorry, excuse this word. This, have you heard of this song? Kol Nidre? Kol, all, Nidre, a nader. A nader is a vow. Now, where did that song come from? Kol Nidre. It's a very haunting melody. Usually the men have their talis and their talises up over their head, and they're singing this three times through, a very quiet time, a little louder than a very louder one. And what this song is doing is this song came about during the time when people were coming up to Jews, sticking a sword under their chin and saying, you have a choice. Convert or I'm going to take your head off. And these people, to save their own lives, converted. Or they said they would do something or not do something and promised. Or in business or in the neighborhood they promised. And they didn't keep their promise, which is a huge problem. So what this is you're asking for forgiveness for the vows that you're obligated to do but did not do, or the vows that were obligated or incumbent upon you or thrust upon you that you didn't do. Okay, that's Kol Nidre. A nader is a vow. It has a very, very difficult... in English, it doesn't translate so well. But saying, is Bleenader, yes. Francis, Bleenader, you've heard me say that. Bleenader, or BLN, sometimes, if I'm typing to you, and I say, sure, I'll do that, I'll give you a call on such and such a date, and I type BLN, that's Bleenader. That means without a vow. Yeah, it's without a vow. Whoa, I'm sorry. So if I say, hey, I'll be at your house this coming Sunday morning for a bike ride at about 10 minutes to 7, I'll be there, Bleenader. Or when my chavrutza and I are studying, and I say to him, and we're of the same generation, and I say to him, same bat time, same bat channel next week, and he laughs because we're of the same generation, and he says Bleenader, which is beautiful. Now I had a very long, now to get this, take it one more step, a little bit more complicated, there is something called the Shavua, and a friend of mine who is studying in Asian Jerusalem, who just recently got married, very cool, would correct me often and not say Bleenader, he would say Bli Shavua, which technically he is much more accurate than I am, but if you ever want to talk about vows and oaths, it can become a very, very complicated and quickly complicated subject. Okay? I'm on a roll tonight. Boy, this is really a bunch. Well, okay. Number two. It is best for a person not to swear at all, which is very true. Even if he's not promising in the name of God or the term referring to God, and if he did swear, he's obligated to fulfill his words. just that it is best for a person not to swear at all. It is also best for him not to make any vows, as he will find himself obligated to fulfill things that he may possibly be unable to fulfill, and then he will find himself lying about his words. If he does make such a vow, he's obligated to keep his words. Very interesting. Okay, got that? No questions? Hi, Mrs. Paul. I don't know who's been... Oh, Paul Day? Is that the missus? Okay. Again, if you take a look at this book, it doesn't come out so well on the video. See this line right there? I'm reading up here, this part down here. Those are all commentaries. They're all commentaries. So those of you who do not have the book are missing half the book. I went dark. I'm sorry. That's because this was up in the camera, and the camera tweaked out or something like that. I'm back. A.K.A. Samantha. Ah. I swear I didn't steal that cookie. Omar, if you're a guy or if you're a kid somewhere around 7 years old, I wouldn't believe it. You took it and you know it. Anything but a cookie for a little kid. Anything but a cookie for a guy. Now, Omar, if you were to tell me, no, I didn't eat my broccoli, I'd probably believe you. Or no, I didn't eat my peas and carrots, I'd probably believe you. But if you say, I swear I didn't eat that cookie, come on. I wasn't born yesterday, like the day before or something. Okay. Got it, Omar? Why? Are you allergic? Omar, are you allergic to cookies? Because I'm going to pick on you because that's a bad example, dude. If you could say, no, I didn't. If you could say, no, I didn't steal those pickled beets. Okay, I could believe you, all right? I didn't eat those jalapenos. I could believe you. But if you're telling me you swear you didn't take a cookie, I'm sorry, dude. You guys are going to have to talk some more. Yeah. And that's the bottom line, Oki. That is absolutely the bottom line. Be very careful. Oh, that's with a J. Jalapenos. Jalapenos. I make a great salsa. I make just a killer salsa. I make just a killer. A friend of mine who is Hispanic taught me how to make this. She's been teaching us some cooking some Spanish food, and oh man, it's good stuff. Yeah, I make this killer salsa, serranos and cilantro and onions and tomatoes and garlic and oil and salt and pepper. Oh, good stuff. Very good. I make it parv so I can put it on anything I want. It's really yummy. Yeah, when Larry and Pam come out, they can watch us cook. They can watch us go through our routine preparing for Shabbos and that insanity. That is going to be insane. So take all sorts of pictures and put them up here. Can we help? Sure, you can help. I always like a sous chef. You can go shopping with us. Yeah, you can go shopping with us and you can help us cook. We usually shop on Thursday and cook. And now that I'm off for the summer, I start my little cleaning frenzy on Friday morning because the wifey is at work. And when I get some of the salads and stuff done on Thursday night, and the other stuff that we have, I do on Friday. B. Gates. What? You just looked at me. What? You help a whole bunch. You're the one who makes half the stuff, the challahs and the beans. She's got a bean recipe that is just killer. And she made some garlic potatoes. Her garlic potatoes are killer, too. Yeah. Nice. Yeah, my friend, my study buddy in Muncie, he shops for the family. He does the shopping. His wife gives him a list and he does the shopping. But anyway. Yeah. Okay, let's get going. Let's keep going. You make an awesome mess. Hey, I'm a neat cook. I clean up after myself, and I don't mind doing dishes. Especially after Shabbos, I do the dishes. I clean the chillant pot. Oh, Larry and Pam are going to try our chillant. Yummy. What, doing dishes? Yeah. Yeah. Well, you'll see. You guys come out, you'll see. Okay, I'm on 277, number 3. Yeah, we'll get the loaf. Okay, we have the loaf kind. And we found some Manischewitz horse. It's wasabi horseradish. It's green. And, you know, when you cut up the carrots with it and the onions, and you cut the loaf up, and you put a little 2 carrots on there, and you can put a little happy face with the wasabi mustard. I mean, wasabi horseradish is kind of yummy. Sorry about that. I like cooking, guys. I love cooking. My wife and I, what is really cool is my wife and I both are, in my humble opinion, are wonderful cooks. Her style is a little different than mine. She makes the best hot and sour soup I've ever had in my life. And her garlic potatoes are world famous, and her salmon is world famous. She can make salmon like I won't even try it. I won't even try to make it. So, anyway, sorry about making you guys hungry, but you guys know the Reader's Digest version of Jewish history? Does anybody explain to you the very short version of Jewish history? Does anybody explain the short version of, you never heard it? The very short version of Jewish history is they hated us, they wanted to kill us, we won, let's eat. That explains every single holiday we have. True, isn't it true? They hated us, they wanted to kill us, we won, let's eat. That's the short version of Jewish history. Think about it. Every holiday we have centers around food. Every single one. Depending on the holiday, depends on the food. Except the next holiday coming up, there's no food. That's called Tisha B'Av of 25-hour fast. It's good for you. Yeah. So those of you in here who are new, if you're not having fun, it's not my fault, okay? Just not my fault. All right, 3. However, someone who finds himself in a desperate situation can vow to God in his prayer so that his promise and intended good deed should stand in his merit and save him from a desperate situation. In this situation, he should say, I hereby vow that I will do such and such if I will be saved from this problem, perhaps in the merit of his promise. Vow, he will be saved. Where is Luisito? Luisito, did you hear what I just said? There's one answer to your question, bud. Did you hear that? There you go. Good. At least I know you guys are paying attention. I feel better now. I think my headphones are skewed. No, it's just my head. Headphones are fine. I got one ear higher than the other. Okay. Similarly, it is proper and praiseworthy for one to make vows in order to correct his behavior and to properly redirect his opinions. How so? One who has a negative behavior trait or habit, for example, gorging on meat, drinking a lot of wine, or other intoxicating drink in an improper way, may make a vow that he will abstain from this thing for a certain amount of time, or someone who fixates on seeking out wealth may vow that he will not accept any gifts for a certain amount of time. All such abstinences may properly be taken out, be taken on with a vow in order to correct one's conduct. However, this is only on the condition that the person will first evaluate himself to be confident that he is able to stand by his word, so he will not eventually transgress his vow and thus be guilty of lying. Did you follow that? Yeah. I think this pretty much sums up the question that Luisito had. Nevertheless, a person should not habituate himself to making vows and should not make many of them. Instead, he should try to separate from his improper behaviors without making promises or vows. Oh, yeah. MJS, wait till you read this week's Torah portion. This is, I'm going to go into this in a little bit, in about a half hour. Hey, Sweepy, I need my little thingy. Well, I could use some more tea, but also the other thing we talked about, 7 o'clock. Hang on a second. Yeah, she can't read my handwriting. I can't, well, yeah, see, when you go through, and someone asked me this question once upon a time, I've gone to college a whole bunch and got a whole bunch of degrees, 2 bachelor's, 2 master's, and a doctorate, counting my smicha and all that good stuff. My handwriting just went right out the window. My handwriting is just horrible. So, if I write something down, I got to transcribe it pretty quick, otherwise I am in deep trouble. I should have been a doctor. I write like one, that's for sure. Yeah, I didn't get high scores in school about that. I think it would be more appropriate to do what you think is best than just promising something specially to God. That's where we get ourselves in trouble, Luisito. And I don't mean to pick on you, but I always find somebody who helps me out with an example, and I greatly appreciate what you just typed. And please, please don't stop asking questions, because this is pretty good. If you take a look, Luisito, take a look at what you wrote. I think it would be more appropriate to do what you think is best. Okay? You have an I and a you in there, than just promising something especially to God. God is our divine parent, correct? It's like me asking Luisito not to ask his parents for anything. You don't want to bother your parents, so just don't ask them for dinner. Don't ask them for some new shoes or your mom to wash your clothes or whatever you had. On the other hand, Luisito, God wants us to talk to him and to ask for things. Things happen in our particular life and lifestyle that makes us draw close to him. A lot of people have a huge difficulty in their thought process of saying, oh, God's busy, I don't want to bother him. He's God. You know, you have a need, you have something, and you have a divine parent who wants the best for you. Just this one. Just this one. Yeah. Okay, Luisito, did that make sense? Did that make sense? And Luisito, if you come into class a whole bunch more often, you'll notice that as I go around, or if you take a look at some of the old classes, listen to some of the old classes, if somebody brings something up that I can use as what they call a teachable moment, okay, if we have a teachable moment, and I can use your example to help me teach a concept, I jump on that real fast. Uh-oh, Eddie's here. We got to stop talking about him. Shh, don't say anything. Eddie's here. Be cool. See, I've picked on Eddie before. So, anyway, Luisito, wow. Luisito, hopefully that helped. Things happen as example. When should one vow in a full way? Just like it says, Bob, do you have the book? Do you have the book, The Divine Code? Where'd Bob go? Bob, do you have the book? Good. Bob, here's your answer. Go to page 277. Go to number 3, second paragraph. And what it talks about in here is, let's suppose there is something, and it's not something you want to make a habit of. Yeah. If there's something that you want slash something that you need, and in essence you're saying, I need help, as an example, financially. I will do this, please, I need help here, I will do this, and that's your vow. Okay? That's how it's used. Okay? Does that clear it up? An oath, do you put your hand up? Do you swear, solemnly swear, to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth? So help you whoever. Okay? Whatever you say, if you've ever been into court, you've ever been up on a witness stand somewhere, thank God I haven't. I have been in court and jury duty, but they never pick me because I argue with defense and the defense attorneys. Yeah, that's. I got a whole panel thrown out once. Did I tell you guys that story? Here's a quick story. I was called to jury duty. It's a true story. I got called to jury duty, and I showed up, and they called 125 of us out. It was a case where two convicts at the local prison were complaining of treatment when the guards went into a room where they refused to leave their cell because they had to search it for drugs. And their complaint was police brutality, guard brutality. So anyway, they impaneled us. I got to be juror number 3. They called me juror number 3. Okay. So this defense attorney takes the direction that he is equating these prison guards who put their life on the line every day to do a very difficult job to the concentration camp guards of World War II. Now, of course, I take my yarmulke, I kind of tilt it forward, and I'm looking at this guy like, I can't believe you just said that. So I was going to say, okay, that's, you know, all right. And he's going on and on and on. He's stopped. And I figure with the next person, he's going to take a different tack. He doesn't. He goes on with the same thing. And he's talking about these prison guards. And then he gets to me. And he asked me what I thought. Yeah. I'm wearing a yarmulke. I mean, I tell him who I am and what I am. And he asked me the same questions. He says, what do you think? I says, well, first of all, my family perished in the Holocaust. I have a lot of family that perished in the Holocaust. And the prison guards don't rush into your cell, ask you to come out, then rush into your cell and pull you out, then find drugs. Okay? They walk up to you, and if you don't comply, they shoot you in the head. You're done. That's the difference between the camp guards and the prison guards. And he and I went at it for about a minute, and the judge stopped. The bailiffs are over in the corner just, you know, yay. They want to applaud me and all that. So he changes his direction. He goes down 2 more people, and he starts in again. I raise my hand. I say, he and I went at it again. We were just arguing back and forth. It was cool. The judge had his head back on his chair. The stenographer is just banging away for all she's worth. Probably went through 5 reams of paper. Everybody else is looking around and looking at me like, wow. But you know something? If you're going to make that type of analogy, don't do it with a Jew. Because I don't sit back and take it. I don't turn the other cheek. If you say something, I'm going to go after you. And I went after this. They ended up taking the entire panel. It was tainted. They took all of 125 of us and sent us home. We were done. And the judge admonished him, I understand, and made him take a different direction for his case. Dude, that was great. So you stand up for yourself. There's people out there who would like to say things, and I have a tendency to stand up and not take it. And I just won't. And that's the reason why I've got the stuff going out here that I have going. I don't put up with stuff. And one of these days, ask me about the Southern Baptist preacher who knocked at my door with his son to tell me about Easter Bunny services and what we did. Tell us now. Well, it was Shabbos, and I was sitting in my living room with my stack of books, and I'm reading. All of a sudden, there's a knock at the door. Bang, 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 bang. So I open the door, and this guy is standing there with his son. His son looks about 15 years old. And he says, I am Reverend such and such, and we have this kind of service this Sunday morning, Easter Bunny Sunday, and we'd like you to come by. And I'm standing there, yarmulke. I got my Arba Kamfa, my four-corner, my tzitzit, you know, with these thingies on. And I had my vest. I was in my Shabbos garb. I don't know what I wear on Shabbos. And I invited him into the foyer because it was a little cold. I want to leave the door open. And so he is really going off on me. And he says something, and I say something to him, and we start a conversation, a theological discussion. And my wife is standing in the kitchen with one of her friends, and they were chit-chatting, having some tea or something like that. And we went at it. And we went at it for over 5 minutes. We're just going back and forth, and what about this and that? And he thought, you know, he was going to do this. He didn't know what he was dealing with. And I just blasted him. Then, towards the end of it, when he was not making points and his son was getting a little bit embarrassed, and I could see his daughter was out on the sidewalk walking back and forth, kind of pacing, because daddy's in this house a long time. A mysterious, mythical, magical, no one heard it but him, cell phone went off. He says, my phone just went on, we have to leave. He turned around and took off out the door. Never, ever saw him again. True story. And someone else told us that the witnesses and the Mormons around here, they have these big maps of blocks and stuff like that. We got a big X over our house because whenever they stop by, I invite them in for a cup of water and we have a discussion. And I guess it's been too many crises of faith. They don't come back to our house at all. I think I've seen in 5 years, I think I've seen 4 Mormons and 4 witnesses in 5 years. And I know some people who get them all the time. I mean, I know people who get door knockers all the time. Kind of fun stuff. Okay, well, those are my 2 stories. The problem with them, MJS, is they rewrote the Bible. They rewrote the Bible. And what the original says and what theirs says, they rewrote theirs. And it's a little thing called the Septuagint. I think there are 14 things that the rabbis who wrote the Septuagint put in. So in future generations, if they were to change it, which we knew they would, if those aren't there or in a different order, then they've obviously changed it from the original. Yeah, they discourage not only free thought, but they prefer if you dropped out of school in the 8th grade. Crazy stuff. Very good, Oki. Go get 'em. Okay. Omar, I'm very happy. You're talking more in the last couple of classes than you did when you first came in. I guess you're feeling more and more comfortable, and I do like a interactive class. So, Luisito, Omar, Omar, Luisito, you guys should meet each other, talk to each other, email each other. But when Omar came in, pardon me, the first couple of classes, he was quiet. Just, he listened. Maybe he was a little bit intimidated. Maybe he didn't have anything to say. Who, me? Si yo hablo español. ¿Qué tal, Luisito? Luisito es muy bien. Gracias, qué bueno. Yeah, I know a little bit of Spanish. So anyway, when Omar first came in, he was very quiet and kind of checked us out. But now it's, I mean, I get killer questions from him. He asks very difficult, very cool questions. So those of you who are in here, I would really... Luisito's a Filipino. Oh, Dagali. I don't speak that. I don't know that. Okay, let's keep going. Number four. This has been fun. This class was particularly fun. Yeah, you know something? Rebecca, that's... let me give you a little bit of teacher methodology, one and all. If you notice the way I teach, I will give you a paragraph. I'll read a paragraph, maybe two paragraphs. Then if there's information in there that really needs to be defined and refined and described and explained, I will do that. And sometimes if it's some pretty amazing stuff like number three, second paragraph, which was a lot, in order to give some of you the chance to reread it two or three times, I'll go off and tell a story. I won't keep going because it is just exactly what you said. It is a tremendous amount of information. In this two-hour class, there is a tremendous amount of of information. Also, this class is up on the web, so if you are not recording it, you can pull it off the web and you can rewatch it and watch my humorous stories over and over again until you're sick and tired of hearing them or something like that. By the way, in case you all don't know, this is called a Johnny Bench. My wife calls it that. I call it an Arnold Palmer. Arnold Palmer's favorite drink after playing golf was lemonade and iced tea. So that's my favorite drink for class. Keeps my throat from drying out and getting all hoarse like it is now. Okay, any questions before I move on? Yes, no, maybe? I'll go find my do-rag and put that back on. Oh, very nice. Mystery juice. Yeah, this was pegged as mystery juice by a person by the name of Pat who came in here, and she called it mystery juice because there was one particular class where we ran out of iced tea or something, and I was expecting iced tea, and I got something like orange Powerade, and my eyes got about this big because I like orange Powerade, but I wasn't expecting it. It was kind of funny, actually. Yeah, mystery juice. Valerian Plant, Pam are going to come out. It's going to be a very interesting time out here. I guarantee that. Pam and Larry are going to be surfing my library. I know that. They're going to be just... Oh. Okay, let me get going. Number four, I'm on the bottom of 277. So hopefully everybody understands my methodology in here. Method to my madness, as they say. A Gentile who vows to bring a burnt offering to God must keep his word. Sans, we don't petition on Shabbos. But you don't have the same requirements that we have. But a Jew never petitions on Shabbos. We don't ask. There's supposed to be over 100 prayers a day, depending in Or Chaim, which is a book of Jewish law, between 101 and 105 prayers a day that we do, and it lists them all out. On Shabbos, because we don't petition. We don't ask God for things like do, etc. All those are taken out. So we're down to 85. There was a story that there was a plague came during King David's time, and people were dying all over the place, and that was when the idea and the thought of 100 brachas a day Jews should do for welfare, well-being, and it stopped the plague. So instead of stopping that, that has been kept up. On Saturday, a Jew has 85 that they do in prayer, etc. I'm not going to go into all the details. So that's why we have such a huge spread on Shabbos. I mean, if you ever want to go into somebody's house and get a meal where I guarantee all day you will not walk away from the table hungry at all, it's on Shabbos because we have an opportunity to do brachas for different kind of things to make up for the 15-plus blessings that we're missing. Okay? This class is getting a little complicated tonight. Sorry. Hopefully you guys aren't sitting there and glazing over. I'll get to the Torah portion in about 5 or 10 minutes. But once in a while it works out that way where there is just a tremendous amount of information to impart. And sometimes I do apologize for stuffing your heads full of stuff, but most of you are brand new at this righteous Gentile thing, and there's a lot of information that you need. Oh, it's an excellent question. Not a problem. But like I mentioned, I forget who asked it, but Bnei Noach don't do Shabbos. Not the way we do it. Okay? All right. No other questions? Okay. Let's keep going. A Gentile who vows to bring a burnt offering to God must keep his word, and so must one who verbally pledges money or charity. You don't have the same obligations that we have, Rebecca. You don't have the same obligations. So if you need something, I mean, you got a 24/7 kind of deal. You don't have the restrictions that we have. Okay? Yeah, it's excellent. It's really good. Good for you guys. We are charged, if you will, to take one day in seven and cease from all our labors. Wow, the whole Bnei Noach just joined. Wow, that's going to be a big class real quick. Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah, if you notice, Bnei Noach just arrived. Wow, I got them all in here, one class. Oopsie. I hate that. If I don't move the mouse once in a while, my wife's screensaver comes up, and it's one of those space shots with the space station and a little astronaut floating around. It's kind of creepy, but it pops up when I don't move the mouse, and it just now popped up and startled me a little bit. You don't see it, but I do, so it's kind of cool because I'm looking at you guys, and all of a sudden I see a spaceman float by. Kind of creepy. All right, I am on... Oh, the wifey left. Something I said? Why does it say you left? Well, am I in the room? I'm in the room. According to this, you're not in the room. Launch not scheduled till Thursday. Is that lunch or launch? What are you launching? Oh! I thought you spelled lunch the same way I do. Poorly. Now, let me do a couple more of these. I'll tell you a wonderful space shuttle joke. Okay, number 5. Who is it? Omar, remind me to tell the story about the rabbi who went into space. Okay? Yeah, they delayed it several times because of the weather. Okay, 5. I'm on 278, number 5. Ooh. I'm not going to get through all this today. Did you get bounced out? I wonder why. Maybe it was something you said. Well, that's what worries me. All right, number five. All the Gentiles are commanded to honor God. It is permitted for them to swear in God's name to prove that their words are true. For example, in a matter of an oath that a witness takes in court, that he will give truthful testimony. Oh, wifey's back. One is permitted to swear in the name of a noted person, such as a king or a respectable officer, or to swear by the life of such a person or by one's own life. This we see from Joseph, who swore to his brothers, be by the life of Pharaoh. I'm not even going to touch that. It is also permitted to swear in the name of well-known righteous Gentile, even if he's not truly righteous, but the masses believe him to be righteous and a faithful person. I read a story about something in the Talmud about a city in the clouds in every man's Talmud. Interesting, the Jews had stuff about space travel way back before it was possible. Oh, there is a stuff in the Gemara, Francis, that I've read as an example. In the Gemara that closed over 500 years ago, there's a discussion on how many habitable planets there are, the size of the universe, how many galaxies, all of this stuff in the Gemara. My wife has just finished a paper in school. Yeah. My wife just finished a paper for school, and it's about, she's doing this class in psychology, and to make a long story short, there was an accident that drove a metal spike in this guy under his chin and came out diagonally across, took out an eye, took out his frontal lobe. Pineus Gage is his name? 1848 Pineus Gage. Look that up in the net. So anyway, they had this guy with this, and he lived. But the thing was, it changed him, and the last 11 years of his life was pretty miserable. He was a completely different person because he lost his frontal lobe. Now, what does this have to do with us? They discovered exactly where the middle of the brain was. Okay, where the middle of it is. How is that important to us? No, I'm discussing the tefillin, the middle of the mind. Okay, so what they discovered is where we put the box for the tefillin that we wear. Have you seen those pictures of the boxes that we wear on our head and on our arm? It's called tefillin, the phylacteries. The placement of that is supposed to be at the center of the head. It's supposed to be lined up between, you know, here and here in the center of the head. And so we've been doing that for a very long time because the frontlets and all that was something that was handed down at Sinai. And we've been discussing on how, where, and when, and still are discussing how, where, and when. And the order. It's very, very interesting. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I thought it was just fascinating. Okay, number six. Although it is permitted for a Gentile to vow by attaching a name of God to another entity, such as a king, a respectable officer, or his own life, it is not fitting to do so, since some opinions say that it is a degradation to combine God's name with another, which that's where I would hold. You okay? Just having a fun swallow? How's your Johnny Bench doing? Just tea? She's a purist. I don't know what statins are. I know what Staten Island is. Oh, okay. Number seven, page 278. If a person is obligated to take an oath at the instruction of the court, he's obligated to make a true oath. True implies two things. A, His words will be true regarding the past. He shall speak truth and not lie in his oath. Regarding a promise he makes about the future, he shall fulfill his promise. He's obligated to swear by something that is reliably true and not false. It has previously been described in this text in part 2, chapter 12, that is forbidden to swear by an idol. And in the case where he must swear by a deity, he should swear by God of the universe, who made the heavens and the earth. Anyone who swears in one of his names or attributive terms referring to God is considered that he has sworn in the name of God. Hopefully you got that one. In other words, I forget who it was, but if you are going to be called to testify in court and you have to put your hand up and say, I solemnly swear, etc., it's okay. You okay? Okay. Who is B'nai Noach? Oh, okay. That's cool, Francis. That's perfectly fine, but she's in. Yeah, but in some places, okay, you can ask for the Torah. That's cool, but usually it's not a problem because what you're doing is you are promising to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you, God. Okay. I don't need a book to swear to that. I just say, as a Jew, I would say that. And if you're slept in front of a Beis Din, if you're called in front of a Jewish court or religious court, the whole process is very different. That's the sort of stuff I'm studying now. It is a fascinating, fascinating study. I'm studying something called Choshen Mishpat, and it's in the Shulchan Aruch, and my chavrutz and I have just been digging into it. It's fascinating, just fascinating. Yeah. Okay. B, he's obligated to swear by something that is reliably true. I already did that one. Number 8. When someone swears by the Torah, or specifically the Hebrew Bible, by saying words equivalent to, I swear by what is written in the Torah, or he takes hold of a scroll or book of the Torah in his hands, or only rests his hands on it for a moment when he makes his promise, it is considered that he has sworn by the name of God. And the holy... I hate when that happens. For the holy names of God are written in the Hebrew Bible. Similarly, if someone swears by God's holy names that are written in books of the prophets of the holy writings, they are part of the Hebrew Bible, or by God's holy names that are written in other holy books, this is considered swearing by the name of God. Yes? Hang on a second. The wife's got a question. I've got to mute you guys for a moment. When the boss asks, I stop. Hang on a second. I tell you, when the Rebbetzin asks a question, dude, her questions are hard. When my wife asks a question, they're hard. She gives me a run for my yarmulke, that's for sure. Which, when Oki and Larry come out, oh man. When they'll get a couple questions. Chase that yummy all the way down the street. Yeah, when the wifey asks a question, they are just interesting. And she's had me go look a couple things up to say show me, and that's fun too. Okay. I'm gonna finish this page, maybe get a little of the other one. A rabbit trail. Yeah. Rabbi trail. trail. Got it. Okay, I understand. When someone did that one, if a court made a Gentile liable to swear under oath, but not with the name of God, he should merely swear without mentioning a name of God or even one of his attributes. Therefore, when a court makes a witness liable to swear, he should only be made to do so without mentioning any of the names or attributive names or attributes of God and without placing his hand on the holy books or text. Huh. And number 10. This is fascinating. One who swears on his own accord, or one who hears an oath announced by others and he affirms his acceptance by answering amen, he's made a vow and must keep his word, since anyone who affirms a vow by answering amen, this is important, or a word that bears the same meaning, such as yes, or I'm obligated in this vow, I accept this vow, or any phrase that has the same meaning, one becomes bound by the vow he affirms. Wow. That's a biggie, guys. That is a huge one. If I say I am going to do something and take a specific vow, and you say amen, or me too, or I'm going to do that. Usually amen said you are as obligated as I am. Let's suppose we're out here in California and Francis is visiting. And somebody comes by the house, knocks on the door and says, we need somebody to clean up the stretch of freeway from here to here on the side of the road. All you got to do is once a month, for 12 months, and you're off the hook, and we'll put your name and your organization up on a little plaque. And I said, sure, I will do it. I promise I'll get it done. And Francis, wanting to be very helpful, says, amen, or amen to that. Guess what? Francis and I are going to be doing it. I'll make her work hard. I'll let her hold the bag. Okay? So, seriously, on the serious side, when you make an oath, you take a vow, you promise to do something. Bob, if somebody, according to what I just read in here, if somebody says they're going to do something and you say amen to that, you're obligated. The best thing to do is they say, you know, lock it and zip it, or zip it and lock it. This is where I want to start next week. On number 10, because I think that's kind of significant. Okay, so you're obligated. Okay, any questions about what we went over? I'm going to start the Torah portion. Okay, I promised Omar I'd tell a story. Everybody know what tefillin is? We know what this is? Tefillin? Do you know what that is? Those are the boxes that we wear on our heads, one on the head, one on the arm, and you put it on in the morning. Every morning except Shabbos or certain holidays, you put them on. Like, I got a holiday coming up where it gets put on in the afternoon service. Ooh, Luisito. You know something, Luisito? Let me say something that I think will put your mind at ease. Okay, Luisito, are you with me? Hang on a second, guys. This is important. You're not the first person that said this, so are you with me? Okay, Luisito, you have walked away from an organization, from a group of people, from a faith that is considered by any stretch of the imagination to be idolatry. Okay? We call it a Avodah Zarah. You have walked away from that and you have embraced seven laws. Okay? Right? And let's suppose you have decided to take on these seven laws and you're going to do it. Are you telling me that you feel that God is not going to forgive you for all those years of doing the other thing? Because that's not correct. By simply you taking a step from where you were to where you are now, and the commitment is to get a couple of books and read them and to know them and be responsible for them, by simply doing that, you've grown leaps and bounds in God's eyes. Now, what's happening now, Lucito, is you're getting chased around, but by who and what you were in the past. And they're trying to entice you back, all right? Actually, I'm ashamed of what I was before. You know something? Lucito, I'll tell you, this is from here. This is honest. Take a look for 60 seconds at who and what you were, okay? Take 60 seconds and say, I'm ashamed of what I've done. I don't ever want to go there again. I'm done. And do that for 60 seconds, Lucito. Then after that, take that whole area of your life, shove it out of your mind, and move forward. Because I do think it's very important, Lucito, that you do not haul that baggage into where you are today. Don't haul that baggage around, okay? Got that? Because what you've done, Lucito, if you've gone from idolatry to a belief in one God, you just make God very happy. Okay? Got that? Got that? Lucito, you take 60 seconds and you feel real bad about where you were for 60 seconds. Look at the clock, watch the hand go around, 60 seconds. When that's up, Lucito, boom, you're done, okay? That is your past. And what I'll tell you what, Lucito, if unfortunately you decide to go back to where you were, and some people do that, though that baggage will be waiting for you when you turn around to get it. How's that for fair? So don't worry, it's there if you want to go back for it. But my honest opinion is to take 60 seconds and say, enough. Okay? Is that reasonable, I hope? Yeah, don't look back. Keep going forward. Good. All right. I promised a story before I got into the Torah portion. Right, Omar, are you paying attention? Omar, are you here? Yeah. Okay. Here's a story. In one of the space shuttle missions, NASA decided to send up three clergy in order to get their thoughts on space travel and space and God. Okay? So they send up a minister, they send up a priest, and they set up a rabbi. And they go up into space, and they go around the world a few times, and they come back. And there's a nice big press conference. And this press conference has, you know, reporters from all over the world. These three clergymen are, of course, you know, brought out around the blue curtain, and they're sitting down. And, you know, they got one guy's a Catholic priest, one guy's, you know, Baptist minister, and this rabbi. And the priest and the minister have these huge grins on their face. I mean, from ear to ear. And the rabbi is just sitting there. So they go to the priest and they said, would you tell us about your experience on the space shuttle? And the priest says, whenever I looked out the window down at Earth, I realized how insignificant I was and the greatness and the breadth and the depth of God's work. Everybody applauds. Yay! Very nice. They get to the minister and the minister looks up and he says, when I looked out the top of the cabin window up in the front of the space shuttle, and I saw all the stars, none were twinkling, I could see all the stars, I could see the moon, I could see for a very long ways, I also found we were very, very insignificant in the vastness of this thing called the universe. Everyone goes, yay, very nice, yay. So I get to this rabbi, and they say to the rabbi, and how was your experience? He said, I hated it. Absolutely, it was the worst thing I ever had to go through. I don't ever want to go again. And everybody's sitting there, you know, gasp, what happened? And he says, some guy held his hand up and says, Rabbi, why did you have such a miserable time? And the rabbi says, once we got into space, everybody knows that it's 90 minutes around the earth, right? He says, once I got into space, it was tefillin on, tefillin off, tefillin on, tefillin off. So he had to put on the phylacteries. Every time he hit daylight again, every 45 minutes, he had to put a tefillin on and daven. And he had to do that for all the time he was up there. So the rabbi had a horrible time. That joke, when I heard that a long time ago, just cracked me up. I thought that was a great one. If you don't understand that one, oh, sorry. Okay, this week's Torah portion. Uh-oh. Yeah. Good, Larry. Okay, these are, like I said, these are the two last Torah portions in this week's Parsha. I mean, in this week, two last Torah portions in the book of Numbers. So, I'm going to take this and put it here. Okay, Matzos. Laws concerning the fulfillment and the annulment of vows. And for us, guys, this is a biggie. For a Jew, this is a biggie. If I make... Gewalt. Sorry. If I make an oath or a vow, and I don't do it, oh man, that's a problem. But in this Torah portion, what is going to be discussed is, what if my wife makes a vow? What if my daughter makes a vow? Are they obligated to fulfill it, or, and this is where we're going to, this is where we're going. The last parsha ended with the laws of Yom Tov sacrifice. This is juxtaposed that whoever vows to offer a sacrifice is obligated to fulfill his promise on the coming Yom Tov and he visits the Beis HaMikdash. So, after last week's Torah portion, this one is beside it, and it says that if I promise to bring a sacrifice to the temple, I'll do it. One should never rashly take an oath or a vow. One who lightheadedly does so and then later fails to fulfill it is likened to a man who takes a sword to stab himself. He's bound to come to harm. Now, what am I using? That book right there. This is a 5-volume set, and it really takes the Torah portion and it kind of breaks it down into something that is palatable and that we can understand. So if you have your Stone Edition Chumash, take a look in the margin on the left-hand side, which is the English side. You'll see the topics, and you can read about what I'm talking about. I'm going to go through this for a few minutes. There are three situations when it is commendable for a God-fearing Jew to make a vow, provided he's fully aware of his commitment. Number one, if someone has acquired sinful habits, wishes to do teshuvah, he may take a vow to strengthen his resolution. If I'm not mistaken, we just finished that in number 10. For example, if he was a glutton, he may vow to abstain from meat for a period of time. If he's a drunkard, to abstain from alcohol. If he's greedy, to refuse gifts, and so on. If a mitzvah presents itself to someone, he may swear to fulfill it so as not to miss the opportunity. And three, there is a tradition from our forefathers, Yaakov, to make a vow in times of distress. Okay, so we just had this discussion in the Divine Code. If you notice, pretty much, the obligation that we have as far as a vow is the same. If something comes up, as an example, if a mitzvah comes up, what kind of mitzvah? Mitzvah to go over to the little old lady's house and mow her lawn. And somebody says, uh-oh, what just happened? And somebody says, we need someone to go over and mow Mrs. Greenblatt's yard. And he volunteers. I throw my hand up because it's a mitzvah, and I say, I will do it next Monday after work. I've made a commitment to mow Mrs. Greenblatt's yard, not right now, but there is a mitzvah that presented itself, and I took the opportunity to obligate myself and to take care of it. In that, we're allowed. In that, according to this book that I just read, the Divine Code, you do the same thing. We also take on vows, and we do things when we are in a time of distress. So hopefully, for those of you who have asked that question, both the Divine Code and Torah has reinforced exactly what I've been saying. An oath or vow is binding when taken from a boy from the age of 13, girls from the age of 12. Since God perfectly understands human nature and knows that a person may regret later his binding vow, he gave us a way to annul it. So therefore, oh, you're out of the room again? How come you keep getting booted out? Maybe because your name's in black. Ooh, that got me in trouble. Well, it's your turn to get booted out this week. It was somebody else's last week. Okay. I understand. A vow or an oath vowed by a 13-year-old boy or 12-year-old girl can be binding. So those people out there who have children, like once upon a time, I had young kids, and I told them about a vow slash oath, and they said they're going to do something, they better well do it. And we talked about the ramifications if they chose not to or didn't. Now, let's suppose you made a vow or you took an oath and you later regret it. Oh, man, I got to be in Scotland that day. I promised to vote to mow that lady's lawn, and somebody else has come by to say, hey, I'll do your chore for you. You got to have a way to opt out of it for yourself. And this is a way to undo or to nullify a vow. If someone makes an oath or a vow, then realize that it is too difficult for him to fulfill. He can either go to a Talmud Chacham. A Talmud Chacham is a person who knows Torah very, very well, who is an expert in the laws, or to three laymen. They can absolve him on the basis of his declaration that at the time of taking the vow, he was not fully aware of all its implications. Had he realized all the difficulties of holding it, he would not have acted so. Thus, the vow was an error on his part. Okay? He explains the details of his promise to the judge or judges, who then determines whether circumstances allow him to grant an absolution. If he discovers a point of regret of which the person who took the oath is not aware at the time, he may absolve him. Machul, machul, machul. That's in the movie. I absolve you. I absolve you. I absolve you. Yeah, it's machul. It's three times to absolve somebody. It's in the movie. Okay, in the movie Yush Pazin. The fact that vows can be invalidated should not induce a person to take them lightly. The Sanhedrin in King Zedekiah's time was put to death for annulling a vow. Yeah, exactly, Paul. That's where Moshe Belanga goes to the Iraqi Jew, and he says he's sorry, etc., and the Iraqi Jew says, don't worry about it. And Moshe Belanga says, you need to absolve me, okay? Absolve me. Say mahu, 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 mahu three times. I absolve you, I absolve you, I absolve you. Yeah, it's a great movie. If you've never seen it, you got to see it. It's a great movie. Okay. No questions? Boy, you guys are quiet tonight. Now, here we go. Annulment of vows. Some vows taken by a girl can be nullified by her father, and some of the married woman's vows can be annulled by her husband. A father has the right to annul a vow by which his under 12-and-a-half-year-old daughter afflicts herself. A husband is empowered to annul any vow that affects the relationship between his wife and loves. That is one tongue twister that I just absolutely love when it pops up. When I call my wife my life, I think that's cool. That's my life over there, which she is. She's my life, my wifey. Okay. The father or husband can annul a daughter slash wife's vow only if he declares his disagreement on the very day he hears about the vow. If he lets the day pass without canceling the vow, he forfeits the right to do so later. Okay? So, I have a wife, I have a daughter that's made a vow, and I come home and say, no, man, this isn't good for the family. I can nullify it. I have a choice. I can nullify it, or I can do nothing. Yes? No. If let's suppose I'm at work and you sign a contract with somebody to pull the weeds out of in front of our house with tweezers, and it's going to cost us $500 a month. I can nullify that. Yes, because there is in Tractate Kedushin, Oki, there is an age at 12 a young lady is referred to as a child. At 12 and a half, she's at that in-between stage between child and 13 being woman. So it's at 12 and a half. For boys, it's at 13. So if a girl at 12 and a half, because she's much more mature than the boy is, makes a vow, the father can nullify it. Yeah. So, what? Any comments, any concerns about this father who's nullifying the vows of his daughter or his wife? Oh, yeah. Francis, yeah. To kill the first person he lays his eye on and his daughter walks out of the house, yeah. I think that's in Judges or something like that. Okay, any questions on this? Well, here's a question I'll pass on to you. Is it reasonable? Who might advise against the father's vows? Who would say that, no, you shouldn't have done that? Hopefully the father will take a look in the mirror and realize what he's done is not in the family's best interest and go find a Talmud Chacham or three wise people and have his vow annulled. But isn't there an issue? Isn't there a problem? Sleepy, what's going on? Oh. She thought she saw a spider. Oh, she hates spiders. I don't like spiders, but she hates them more than I do. Let's suppose you have a wife who's made a vow. Do you have any problem with the husband nullifying the wife's vows? Does the father have to say he annuls her vow three times? There's a whole process on how that's done, but mostly it's the husband that nullifies the vow of the girl or the mother. Nobody has a problem with that? Yes, no, maybe? Wow, you guys are quiet tonight. Okay. Why should a husband have the power to tell his wife what to do? Or not do? No, that's completely different. Because usually back in this time, and a lot of times today in some Orthodox communities, the wives don't go out and work. The wives stay home. So the husband, as it should have been and should be now, is the primary breadwinner. And he has the right to nullify the vow made by the daughter to make it incumbent upon her. He can nullify, or upon the wife. The wife makes something that's not in the family's best interest, he can nullify it. But he can also not say a word, and she or the family is obligated. Okay? Depends on the dad. Depends on the mom. Wow, I see the father, husband must be the head of vows in his household. Responsibility. Yeah, actually, MJS, the father is really responsible. However, the mom's responsibility is with the teaching of the children and making sure that the household's a kosher household and to make sure that the kids are sent to the right schools and they're learning and all of that stuff. So even though the father can nullify it, the mother's really the driver here. Okay? But the head of the household takes it in the neck. A father during at the end of a bar mitzvah, after the kid does its Torah portion in his little drasha, the father says he thanks God for no longer being responsible for this. So at age 13, the father is going to go up when the kid's doing his bar mitzvah and tell the congregation and the kid, hey, thank God I'm not responsible for the stuff you do anymore. Is that harsh? I did that and I was chastised by some people because they thought it was a little bit shocking. Does it mean that if you have a working wife, the husband has no authority to nullify his wife's vows? Now there's a question for the ages. Wow, Lisita, you and Omar, between the two of you, are going to turn this old gray, this head gray. That, the vow stuff, was assuming that the wife was a stay-at-home wife. If the wife makes it and she's out there making her own income, it's a different matter. And what I would do with you is, Lucito, I would go see your local rabbi. Because that would be a very difficult question. I would go see your local rabbi. Can a vow be nullified even if the person she made the vow with has already started before the father arrived home? Can the vow be nullified? Yes. Yes. Of course it's the opposite. Does the physical age still apply for special needs developmentally challenged child? Toria, a special needs child cannot make a vow. That is never, it's even in American jurisprudence, if you're a person who really cannot sign a contract, it's against the law. You cannot sign a contract with somebody who is somehow developmentally challenged, disabled. You can't do it. And it's the same thing in Jewish law. You can't contract with a person who does not have all their faculties. Because there are parts of a contract, and some of those people can't hold up their end of the bargain. Okay? Got that? So if you got a person who's a special needs person, you don't sign a contract with them. You don't sign a contract with a minor. You don't sign a contract with a child. You don't sign a contract with somebody who is not emotionally capable or mentally capable of holding up their side of the bargain. So you can't do it. Okay, hopefully that was clear. Now the last part, let's see. The last part is preparations of the war against Midian. To bring this together again, and this is one thing that I like to do with a Torah portion, and here's where I'm going to end it because the video is coming up in about 2 minutes. Balak and Bilam. Balak got Bilam to come to him than go and to curse the children of Israel. So he goes up on the mountain, he sets up seven altars, and he slaughters and invokes God's name, even though God said, don't do this, it's wrong. He sent an adversary, the whole thing with the donkey's mouth opening up, etc. All of that has occurred. The Midianite girls end up in the children of Israel's camp, and they bring the little statue, a little thing called Baal Peor. They set it up, you either have to urinate on it or defecate on it or both, and you get to have the girl. And that was the way it was worshipped. Kind of disgusting, but that's the way it was. The girl said, hey, if you poop on this thing, I'm yours. Guys laughed, you know, did their business on a little statue, and they got the girl. Along comes Cosby, who was destined for Moshe Rabbeinu's tent, ended up intercepted by Zimri, and in the middle of the act, Pinchas comes in, runs them both through, holds them up, and the plague stops. Okay? There's a lot more, but I'm giving you the Reader's Digest version. And the plague stops. Pinchas is raised to the level of Kahuna. All right? Now, let's take it a little further. This week's Torah portion talks about the coming battle against these people. These people came in, they made an attempt to take the children of Israel off the task and out and off the road that we were set, the road what we're supposed to do. They were there for the purpose of hauling us off and getting God mad at us and somehow somebody cursing us and God to destroy us. So we wouldn't have to go into the promised land. So what happens? The Midianites try their part. It doesn't work. And so God is indignant. The children of Israel are indignant. And they prepare for war against the Midianites. And the last part of this Torah portion goes over the preparations for war, who goes, who doesn't go, what do you do with captives. Let's suppose in the heap of battle, you come around the corner and there's this gorgeous-looking Midianite girl, and you just have to have her. Okay? She's just got to be yours. Jews don't do the whole raping and pillaging thing. It's just against who and what we are. But if you end up with a strong need to take this person, you take this person home, the person mourns for 30 days because obviously mom and dad she'll never see again, whether they're alive or not is irrelevant, won't see them again. And after 30 days, you clip her nails, you dunk her in the mikvah, and you can marry her or you can send her off. Up to you. You got 30 days between the time you took her and the time you married her, in order for you to cool off because of the heat of battle, and for her to mourn the loss of her family. So this stuff is very, very, very rational. It makes all sorts of sense. If you have a group of people, the IDF today, the IDF has been accused by some huge organizations of war atrocities, God forbid. We don't. There are a couple of people out there who periodically step on it, so to speak, but as a rule, the IDF both does not condone wanton destruction of people, property, and things, nor do they condone some of that, what I refer to as bad behavior. It is not at all condoned by the Israeli military. In some places, it's overlooked, swept under the rug, etc. But there is a higher level of ethics that the Israeli soldiers must abide to. So, Oki, if you'll put up the CD, I want to thank everybody for coming in. It's been a marvelously wonderful evening. Next week in Torah, we start the Book of Devarim, which is the book of Deuteronomy, which was supposed to be more of an epilogue. We end up with 200 more mitzvahs in this. So, and I do really appreciate it. I'll stick around for a minute or two. If you have any more questions in the text, I will be more than happy to put it up. Enjoy Adiran. Good night, all. Be well.